You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
It's Wednesday, the 12th of June, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop. Summer's on its way, but like so many ambitious major projects, there have been inevitable delays, and handover's been put back probably by about a year. So that's my commentary on the climate change crisis at the moment, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm very well, David. I am doing very well.
I'm glad to hear that.
Keeping busy. I'm getting moderately bored of all this election stuff. We have to talk about it this morning, of course.
Of course.
Kind of all that's happening, really. But folks, stay with us. And if you don't hear about the election, just skip forward about 20 minutes, because we are going to talk about other things today, quite deliberately, things which have got nothing to do with the election. But this is the week of the manifestos. We're talking on Wednesday. The Labour one, which is the only one that matters, frankly, is coming out tomorrow. I have no idea how right the polls are, but I don't believe they're completely wrong. So I think I'm just going to join in everyone else's assumption that the next government will be a Labour government. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the fact that the Tories have promised to build 3 million houses in the next 5 years is irrelevant on two counts. One, they're not going to be in government. And two, they can't do it anyway. I think we've discussed this previously. We don't have the people. It's impossible. Won't happen. So there's no point even looking at the Tory party manifesto. All that said, I was interested to see they're going to stop building waste incinerators, and even some that have started construction a little bit will be scrapped. So that was news to me, but irrelevant.
Yes, I think you're probably right. I mean, their recent announcements over the last, well, since the announcement that they were going to have an election, they've all been, I think, I was going to say calculated to appeal to the greatest number of potential swing voters, but I don't think there's any calculation in it at all. They're just grasping at straws. So the idea of bringing back national service, for example, that should get the or the elderly right-wingers on side. And, getting rid of waste incinerators, which actually I'm in favour of. I think that waste incineration is much better than burying it in landfill. That's obviously for the NIMBYs. So, yeah, I don't think that they have anything really worth considering. So, yeah, all eyes are on the Labour Party manifesto tomorrow.
And I think that's all been fairly heavily trailed. Bottom line is they've got no money, so they will have been exactly the same bind that the current government in is. And maybe over two terms, we might see some things change, but I don't think anything's going to happen too quickly. But what I would like to talk about this morning is not what the parties or the next government may or may not do, but what the construction industry has been pushing for. We've had various things coming out from different organisations. Federation of Master Builders, for example, they want a Secretary of State for Housing. Housing so important, they said the Minister for Housing should be put in the Cabinet. Well, that's ludicrous, because the problem is not that the Minister for Housing has not got enough seniority. The problem is that we've had, I've lost count, whether it's 16, 17 or even 18 now, Ministers of Housing since 2010. They just change them around in average tenure is about 10 months. No one can do anything in that period of time.
No.
They just need to put someone in the job who has some sort of knowledge and interest and keep them there for a good length of time, rather like what they did with, I was going to say, Nick Gibb at schools, but he came and went a couple of times. And whether you agree with what he did for schools or not, he did things. He was able to do things, effect change, because it takes time as a minister to implement change. And chopping them, changing the whole time, of course there's been no proper, sensible housing policies that have cut through. So that's not a problem. We'll come on to this document in a minute, but another document saying there should be a Secretary of State for Infrastructure Infrastructure is so important, we should have a Secretary of State for infrastructure. And I'm thinking, okay, so we're going to have a Secretary of State for infrastructure, a Secretary of State for housing, presumably we want to still want the Secretary of State for transport and for energy. We'll still have a business Secretary of State. Procurement will still be in the Cabinet Office. I mean, that's going to make the problem worse. The more you divvy it up between these different people, they've got different fiefdoms, you're going to have, whether it's a, at the moment, if it's a road, it's transport, if it's a power station, it's energy. Yeah. But if you take roads and railways out of transport and put it into infrastructure, or you take power stations out of energy and put it into infrastructure, this new department, I don't get it. I don't think
it's the opposite of joined up government, isn't it? It's you know, government chopped up into little pieces.
Unless you say, let's scrap energy, scrap transport, scrap, you know, put water, the water bit of the Environment Department or the or Agriculture and Fisheries, whatever department that is now, and put all of that into infrastructure. Mm. And that will just become such a huge department. In 3 years' time, people say, oh, it's too big, it needs to be broken up. So, anyway.
You can't win. So you've been having a bit of a rant, haven't you, in the last couple of weeks, Phil? You've got some strong opinions about this, particularly the suggestion that infrastructure should be depoliticized. In fact, you wrote quite a long screed about that on the website.
I have only, I think, once before in the 10 or 15 years I've been running the Construction Index News Service. I can remember doing it after the collapse of Carillion. I felt so agitated by a lot of tosh that was being written about Carillion that I felt moved to write a long piece of that. And of course, no one agreed with me. They never do. And 3rd of June, we got this document called Blueprint for Growth from, it's not from Build UK. It's not from any of the trade associations. It was just a coalition of construction companies, and I'll name them. Atkins, Balfour Beatty, BAM, Costain, Galliford Try, Lang O'Rourke, Mace, Morgan Sindall, Mott MacDonald, Vinci, Volker Vessels, and WSP. So three big consulting engineers, nine big construction companies who've come together and joined in to say, this is our blueprint for growth. And I thought, this is interesting. It's interesting that we've talked before how Build UK is a strange, curious coalition of what used to be the big construction and then the supply chain, and now it brings it all together. And there are clearly going to be inherent conflicts of interest within that organisation that have to be managed and negotiated. And this is sort of big construction breaking free and saying, no, this is what we the big business want. I thought, okay, interesting. Well, let's see what they've got to say. And blow me, their very first recommendation in big, bold letters, our recommendations, depoliticize infrastructure. Now, infrastructure, which is the provision of transport, energy, clean water, sewage services, all the things that we know of, broadband these days. I mean, it is crucial to civic society, to running the organization of a country. Politics is the process of reaching decisions for the running of a country. I mean, the very idea that you can depoliticize infrastructure, the idea that somehow the people, I think I mentioned in my piece, that, you know, the people in Suffolk who are not keen about having Sizewell C built and all either the disruption of the construction or the power station itself. Of course they're going to be upset. But big construction comes along and says, no, this isn't politics. This is infrastructure. We need it. Let's just do it. Now, I get where they're coming from. What has always frustrated the construction industry is that the government says, we're going to build a nuclear power station, for example. And then there's an inquiry, and then it's debated in Parliament, and it gets knocked backwards and forwards. And then there's a new government who comes in and says, no, we're not going to do that. And then they're not going, yeah, we are going to do that. And it can take decades for projects to, you know, big projects to get off the ground. And there've been all sorts of reforms in recognition of that to address these delays, notably the development consent order application rather than a big public inquiry that we used to have can go on for years. And that speeded things up. And still, construction, wants to go, no, quicker, 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 cut out all these opportunities for challenge. And in this paper, they're saying that we need to make decisions more quickly. It's all these stupid people opposing our schemes. I mean, they shouldn't be listening to them, or maybe listen to them a bit, but not very much. But the whole tenor of this document is all about, I mean, it's clear, naked, vested interest. And why not? I mean, that's what lobbying is all about. But it's unsubtle. It's not, it's frustratingly stupid that where it's coming from. I mean, it's just that very first point that got me going. Had they not said depoliticize infrastructure, I might have looked at it and said, oh, yeah, they would say that. But that first sentence wound me up so much.
Yeah, clearly.
It is political.
Yeah, of course it is. But it's also human nature. You know, I mean, we all bridle at bureaucracy and authority meddling in our affairs and basically getting in the way of us getting on with our lives and preventing us from doing our jobs. And you can imagine if you're the boss of a big civil engineering contractor and you want to build this road or this bridge or this tunnel or whatever it happens to be. And, you know that there's a good business case for it. You don't want people constantly saying, oh, just hang on a second. Or no, you can't do this. You can't do that. You want to be given the go ahead and then back off and let us do it. That's basically what they're saying. You know, make the decision and then back off. And in a way, you can understand that. And you made the point yourself about the fact that we have so many, you know, it's just a merry-go-round of sort of musical chairs in Westminster where you have a secretary for housing one week and then you've got another one the next week and nobody's in office long enough to actually see through something like a major infrastructure project. I mean, no government can be, sure of seeing through a major infrastructure project because there's always the risk that they're going to be voted out of office. So you've got this short-termism of government and the infrastructure, you know, the contracting and construction sector are saying, this is too short-term. We've got to be able to look longer into the future and be more certain of the outcome. So you can see why they're frustrating.
No, I can. And if their first number one demand, instead of saying depoliticize infrastructure, had been streamlined bureaucracy, would have been entirely different thing. And we said,
That's semantics, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's not. No? It's always going to be political. Saying is, and they go on to say it, this is how the way to depoliticize infrastructure. And we heard this when the National Infrastructure Commission was set up in 2015, whatever. The National Infrastructure Commission was set up, and the phrase was used then, to depoliticize infrastructure. Mm-hmm. That was the rationale behind it. The idea is that you get experts, who we used to like, to decide what infrastructure the country needs, and set out a 10-year plan, and then Parliament will go, right, yeah, we'll have that. And then there is this plan, and then the government Treasury publishes a pipeline of construction. That all happens. That was meant to be the solution. Clearly, it's not been the solution because, of course, it hasn't depoliticized it. Just because we have a National Infrastructure Commission who says we need a nuclear power station in Suffolk is not going to make the people of Suffolk suddenly roll over and go, oh, okay, then. and what this blueprint for growth is saying is that it doesn't specifically bang out on about Sizewell C, but I'm using it as a highly political project. It may well be in the national interest, but this document is saying it's in the national interest. The local people should bloody well shut up.
Yeah.
Writ through this document, whether they meant it or not, what comes out is quash the little man, silence the little man. We're big construction. We should decide what we need to build. Let us build it and everyone else should just shut up and go away. Now, clearly the tipping point for many of the people behind this document, I'm sure, was the cancellation of HS2.
Yes.
But are we really saying that just because you have a 10-year plan, if things change, if the construction industry either lies in its cost estimates and says this is what it's going to cost, then they get the con and say, oh, no, it's not. Actually, it's going to cost five times that because they've either been incompetent or they've lied. One of those two things could be only reason, or because politics have got in the way. This is probably actually what happened with HS2. Politics got in the way and the whole thing's in tunnel virtually. I don't know what percentage, but something about two thirds of it between London and Birmingham is now in tunnel.
Mm.
So as not to upset people. And that's escalated the costs hugely.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear the construction industry say, oh no, we shouldn't put it in tunnel. We should keep it above ground. They're going, great, put it in tunnels. Yeah, more money for us, more building for us. Let's put it in tunnels. So the rule for politics there.
You also made a point. You made a point, which I thought was quite a good one in your piece. I mean, you made several points, but you mentioned that, you know, if you basically ring fence these major infrastructure projects like HS2, like Sizewell C, you know, big multi-billion pound projects, and then you get a financial crisis and the government has to do some uncomfortable arithmetic to work out where they're going to save money. You know, if they can't cut an infrastructure project like HS2, what are they going to cut? Is it going to be social care? Is it going to be the NHS? Is it going to be, you know, sort of local government?
Well, presumably the construction industry would be happy to shut social care because there's not much construction involved. We'll close down hospital surgeries and lay off nurses, but we'll keep building hospitals. Can't cut that.
Yeah.
No, it's barmy. Governments have to be allowed to govern, and there's no other way through that. The alternative is saying we have this 10-year plan and it is immutable, which is what they're saying. This should be immutable. And not only that, it should be the National Infrastructure Commission that is in charge of it rather than the government delivering it. Hive it off rather like, I mean, I've heard, I think it's Rory Stewart's book or it might have been Liz Truss, there's been a lot of discussion about how transport secretaries of state have been enormously frustrated. They can't actually do anything on the roads because the Highways Agency, Highways England, whatever it's called,
National Highways is so
devolved that actually the Secretary of State doesn't have much power over anything. And if we're, as this blueprint for growth document suggests, give National Infrastructure Commission the sort of power, not just for deciding what big infrastructure gets built, but also give it responsibility for delivering big infrastructure, for being the client organisation. That's an enormous amount of governmental and financial responsibility in one unelected body. Mm. It's hideous, frankly. And I just cannot believe that the authors of this document, and I have a funny feeling. I don't want to personalise it. I think I know. It was sent out by the company that put this document out was Balfour. It was the Balfour Beatty's publicity machine that put it out, and they have within their, I think their chief lobbyist is not someone of a totalitarian bent. They used to work for Nick Clegg, so it's I don't know who's got hold of this document and made it so batty. Or maybe it's just a camel and it's been bitten by committee and people have let this sort of mad language go.
I'd love to hear what they say in response to that.
Oh, they don't care what I think. No one listens to me.
Well, what do you think? Why are we doing this, Phil? Why are we doing this? Some people do. We've got a listener out there saying, what about me? Anyway.
Well, that's what we're doing. We're doing
we'll see what people say.
For the little person who
wants
to go, hang on a minute. Yeah. Anyway, that wound me up. Anyway, there's another document, slightly, just briefly on this one. The Construction Leadership Council put out a much more rational, frankly, open letter. Now, whereas Blueprint for Growth is plain naked lobbying for big construction, the Construction Leadership Council, it says it's called the Construction Leadership Council Open Letter, but it's not, because Construction Leadership Council is an organisation that consists of government minister, civil servants and construction industry representatives. This is the construction industry people who have written this letter.
Yeah.
And I think they're, if I was the minister, I'd probably slap them on the knuckles a little bit, ever so gently and quietly in the background, for using
for
the offices
political.
Using the offices of the CLC.
Yeah.
For this exercise,
yeah.
I I would be upset if I was a minister, because that's not what the CLC is for. Now, they very clearly say in this open letter, we are a non-political organisation, but we would like to offer some advice to a future government. We don't care who the future government is. We've got no opinion on that, no view on that. Mm-hmm. But whoever it is, we've got some advice for you. So we're not lobbying. It's not political. It's just, you know, some advice. Now, yes. The reason why, in general, this is better advice than this, the blueprint for growth, is that the signatories of this are a wider construction. They include our friend Brian Berry from the Federation of Master Builders, for example, mm-hmm. which is the small builder viewpoint. There's a guy from the Green Construction Board. There's civil engineering contractors, electrical contractors, National Federation of Builders, Construct Zero. So you've got different people who represent different organisations. The only people who don't represent organisations who are there just by virtue of being someone that the minister wants to have around is the guy from Mace, Mark Reynolds, and the guy from Atkins, Richard Robinson. That's the industry side chair and vice chair. I think Richard Robinson is due to take over at some point as the industry side chair. So it's from a wider cross section of vested interests, but there's still vested interests. And it's saying some of the same things, sensible things that Blueprint for Growth is, in terms of we need a plan and we should try and stick to it, please, as much as possible. It mentions, the CLC document mentions continuing reform of prompt payment legislation, which, of course, Blueprint for Growth doesn't care about that, because that's a little man. We're a big construction. We don't care about prompt payment. In fact, we kick that into touch. Planning reform, saying, and unlock small sites. And it's all the stuff we've been hearing before. But one thing it also mentions, which is they want to bring in more private funding, revive in some way, form or another, the private finance initiative. In their words, they advise the next government to open a conversation with industry, quote, to further explore the role of private finance to deliver some of the currently government-funded projects in the pipeline in order to deliver, basically to get things built off books. And that's exactly what the private finance initiative was all about. And I've done a quick history lesson on this subject on our I posted it yesterday, it's in this morning's newsletter. Stories about CLC lobbying for almost PFI revival, but not entirely. PFI has been clearly discredited. And the new thing is the model that was used to build Thames Tideway. And that's also what's going to be used for, if it happens, Sizewell and the next nuclear. There's legislation being brought forward for that. Now, that works in the energy sector and in the water sector, because they're already in the private sector. And we pay our water bills, we pay our electricity bills. And this new model of paying will just, like Thames Water Customs have been paying, I don't know what it is, £10 a month, year, whatever, for the past however many long. They've already been paying for Thames Tideway up front, rather than borrow now, pay later, which was the PFI model.
Yeah.
I don't know how that will work with the roads, for example, unless we move to a road pricing model. If we move to a road pricing model, which the Tories have said they won't, but that's irrelevant because they're not going to be the next government. I mean, infrastructure, which is still in the public sector, the regulated asset base, I don't think that model, I don't think will work. I mean, it is a regulated, they do have their regulated spending period now, national highways. But unless we either hypothecate fuel duty or some other way, put you know, tenpence on a liter of fuel, or a tax on electricity charging points for your electric cars, I don't see how the regulated asset base model is going to be able to build more roads, although no one seems to want to build more roads anyway at the moment.
No, well, I think that's probably true. I mean, I also think that road pricing is inevitably going to come along on a large scale. I mean, if you know, we've were supposed to, was it 2030 or 2035 now, that we're supposed to be phasing out internal combustion engines and all go electric? You know, if we are really going to reduce our consumption of diesel and petrol, then there's an awful sort of income stream from tax, which we're going to lose there. So they're going to have to get it somewhere else. So I think road pricing is going to have to happen, whatever model they use to build roads, if they build roads.
You may very well be right.
Anyway, so I think, I also think that, as you indicated, PFI is such a sort of toxic concept now that they're going to have to call it something else if they're going to introduce anything which looks at all like PFI. You know, people just aren't going to accept it anymore.
Which is why it's now called regulated asset. But have I got that right? Is it regulated asset base?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
they're going to have to say Rachel Reeves will be pushed by the construction industry, by Construction Leadership Council, saying, right, you've got this model now for, it's got Thames Tideway built. Let's spin this in the same way that when PFI was essentially created under the Tory governments of Thatcher and Major, it was Gordon Brown as Chancellor who then said, right, we've got this. Now we can get more stuff off balance sheet and put whole loads of stuff through PFI, which never should have been because there wasn't a proper customer paying revenue stream like hospitals and schools.
Yeah.
PFI is basically DBFO in the private sector, you know, with private ownership, with no transfer at the end, maybe or maybe.
DBFO being design, build, finance and operate. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
The first one the Channel Tunnel was one, but a simpler one to get your head around is the Dartford Bridge, where Trafalgar House went to the government and said, we'll build a bridge over the Thames between Dartford and Thurrock if you let us collect the tolls for, I think it's 25, 30 years, whatever. Of course, the tolls are supposed to be lifted after that period, and they still haven't been, they never will be. So there was a con. But it got it built. And the point is that it transferred all the risk to Trafalgar House. So they got it built on time and on budget, I think. Did a good job, good infrastructure, and it cost the taxpayer not a penny. It cost the motorists who use it money to cross, but they're, you know, for the extra service, they're prepared to pay for it until the queues got stupid. Now, with hospitals and schools, you can't say to patients, you've got to pay to get into this hospital because the NHS is a religion. You can't do that.
You have to do that in the States.
So the government was saying, right, well, how are we going to do this? Well, we'll pay you for cleaning the hospital for 30 years, for, you know, washing the sheets, manning security, doing the food, cleaning, whatever.
Yeah.
The janitor stuff, the maintenance stuff. And therefore, they invented this revenue stream. And that's how Gordon Brown got hospital building off the books.
Yeah.
But of course, what happens is you end up paying far, 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 far more in the long run, and trusts go bust and contractors go bust, and it all just goes, you know, after collapse of Carillion, all the chickens came home to roost. And it was Philip Hammond, when he was Chancellor, said,
yes, he was a Chancellor, yeah.
Never again. We're not going to do no more PFI.
No.
Meanwhile, regulated asset base model had come in. It's a different way of doing it, paying up front rather than on tick. So that's going to be, I think Rachel Reeves will be grabbing hold of regulated asset base and trying to do something creative with that if she wants to get anything built. Right, I've done enough talking, David. I've got a question for you. I'm going to change completely away from politics now.
Go on then.
You told me you've been, for the next edition of the Construction Index magazine, talking to some interesting people. Who have you been talking to?
I have. Well, I've got this feature which I run in the magazine now, which is which we call SME Focus, or SME Profile rather. And actually, most of the companies that I've profiled so far in the magazine have been quite big SMEs. I mean, the government changed the specification of what SME means recently. So some of them are perhaps bigger than your average sort of builder on the street corner sort of thing. But no, I've been speaking to a particularly interesting company called Red 7 Marine, which I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with. It's a company with an interesting history. does very interesting work. Basically, they're a specialist subcontractor and equipment hirer to a large degree, working in the near shore marine environment. So they don't go out into the middle of the North Sea and, you know, work on oil rigs or stuff like that, but they do do stuff around the coast and in estuaries and rivers and stuff like that. And a lot of our listeners will have seen their jackup rigs, for example. They're fairly distinctive. If you know what a jackup rig is, it looks like a upside down table. Until they jack it down, then it looks like a table. It's a big barge, and it provides a sort of working platform for things like piling and infrastructure, that kind of thing. Now, they, as I said, it was a privately owned family company, basically, launched by a chap called Nick Offord, who's recently retired. In fact, only a couple of months ago, he retired. And the company, you know, like many small family businesses, sort of evolved gradually. And then in order to, partly to sort of weather the storm of recession and various other things, COVID, Brexit, that kind of thing, sought private investment, which was a mixed blessing, I think we can say, in this particular case. The company had difficulties. It had cash flow problems, basically. It was a sound business, essentially a sound business.
That was pre-COVID, though, and all of that, wasn't it?
Now, I mentioned COVID and Brexit. It was certainly pre-COVID. But the company had two sort of strings to its bow. It was Nick Offord's business merged with another business, which was basically in diving. That's what its expertise was. And so the company was both sort of like jack-up rigs.
Industrial diving inspections?
Industrial diving, yeah. Yeah,
not snorkeling with dolphins?
No, nothing like that. No, we're talking industrial stuff. So it had these two strings to its bow, and the two were complementary, but not entirely... What's the best way of describing it? I'd say not entirely coordinated, but that's not really fair. I mean, they were semi-autonomous, if you like. And it was a diving business which really came a cropper, and the company went under effectively and then was revived. They bought in another investor.
When are we talking? 2018 or 2017?
Oh, you're asking me questions now about timescales. I can't remember. It was relatively recently when the latest investor, the second investor, came on board. I think it might have been 2019. When I finished writing the feature, I haven't actually finished it yet. I will be able to confirm that. Yeah, they came on board, and basically they could see that this was a sound business that basically just had a cash flow problem, and they tackled that. They tackled it head on. And in fact, the chap who led the investment team actually bought out a controlling share of it. And
John Walsh?
John Walsh, thank you very much. Yeah, so John Walsh came on board. And he really liked the business. In fact, as Nick Offord said, he fell in love with the business and decided to buy it. He wanted to own it, not just to manage it. And he now has a majority share in the business. Nick Offord sold out his share of the business and has retired. He bought on another man, much younger chap, but with a background in a similar sort of field, Kristen Branford, who is now the managing director of the firm. Also very enthusiastic chap with a great, you know, very good sound construction background. And he has a 30% share, and a couple of the other directors have the remains of the shareholding. And, they've actually gone from strength to strength. Very recently, they've done some major jobs. They've invested in equipment. Actually, you name a job in a river or along the coast, and almost certainly they've had one of their jack-up barges there. I'm thinking about whose football stadium was it on the,
Fulham, on the banks of the,
yeah, Fulham.
Was it Fulham,
yeah,
Fulham or Chelsea?
No, Fulham. I think it was Fulham's new stand. They were involved with that. Dover Docks. They did a lot of piling there.
Used to be always the Dutch. It used to be the Dutch that would do these things, wouldn't it? It'd be Volko or one of these sort of people who used to dominate the jack-up barge business.
Absolutely. And they still do. I mean, it was very interesting speaking to Nick Offord about this. He was instrumental in the setting up of a global sort of trade association, if you like, called IJUBOA, the International Jack-Up Barge Operators Association, IJUBOA. And now he's devoted entirely to that. He's not completely retired. He's not gone off to play golf now. He's backed away from Red 7, but he's now deeply involved with IJUBOA still. And I was asking him about this, and I was saying, you know, is the UK, obviously, IJUBOA is based in the UK. He helped set it up. He's a very influential figure in the sector worldwide. I mean, Red 7 Marine does a lot of work overseas as well. And I said, so yeah, is the UK, you know, still punching above its weight? Because I said, you know, it's the Dutch and the Belgians who you always are the go-to people for this sort of work, you know, sort of land reclamation and marine construction, that kind of thing. And he said, well, no, the UK isn't punching at all. Basically, we just, you know, he said that we've got companies like Red 7 Marine, basically a small company and or a small to medium sized company, at least. He said there should be, you've got these big tier one contractors who are his client base or Red 7's client base. He said they should be doing this. They should be investing in this. You know, if we wanted to be, you know, a leader in the field, it should be the big infrastructure companies that are doing this sort of work, not relying on small companies like Red 7. But Red 7, obviously, a very capable company, and it's not the only one. But no, it's the Belgians and the Dutch who are really sort of setting the pace in this sector still. You know, they've got a lot of history in marine engineering and marine construction, and they're still basically at the cutting edge.
I could think of some Dutch. I mentioned Volko. I probably meant Van Oord is the one I was thinking of.
Oh, yeah.
Who are the Belgians?
Sarens, I suppose. They do quite a lot. They've got barges.
Okay. I think of them as just as, you know, cranes and heavy lift. But yes, yeah, they probably do have barges as well. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. And there are others, one or two other sort of Flemish names which don't exactly slip off the tongue. I can't remember their names, but there are other Belgian companies that do a lot of work like this.
You mentioned John Walsh. I had a quick look at his LinkedIn profile earlier on today, and he seems like he's got quite an interesting background as well. He was 10 years in the Navy in the 80s, reaching chief engineer in the Royal Navy. Mm-hmm. Then John Lang Construction for 10 years, working on MI6 building, and other, amongst other things.
Oh, yeah.
Imperial College, director of construction. And then started running all sorts of businesses, doing sort of rescue and turnaround things. Mm-hmm. So, he's clearly got an engineering background, and in the Navy and civil engineering.
Sure.
So he seems like
he's got all the right credentials, and you know, he knows what he's doing. You know, I don't think he would have made a bid for a controlling share of a company like Red 7 Marine unless he saw that company had a bright future ahead of it. And it's got an incredible track record, actually, despite its financial woes, which, you know, anybody can come a cropper. You know, you grow to a certain size, you overreach yourself, I suppose. Any company can find itself in difficulties, but it doesn't affect the fact that it's basically a sound business.
This is purely a guess, I'm just supposing, that if I was in the jack-up barge business, I would have looked at the wind turbine, offshore wind market a few years ago. So, this is great for us. Let's buy a new kit. Let's tool up. And this goes back to our earlier conversation. You tool up seeing this big, revenue stream coming down the pipeline. And then bloody politics gets in the way.
We're back to that again.
A wind farm. It gets put on hold or doesn't get built. They say they were going to build it, but people objected, so it didn't get built. And you're left with all this kit that you've bought on the tick, and you've got no revenue to pay back the interest rate on the loan or whatever. I wouldn't be at all surprised if they came they fell victim to the stickiness of the offshore wind market, the lumpiness of it.
I don't think, well, offshore wind is certainly important to the company. I mean, it doesn't go out and install these great big monopiles that the turbines sit on out in the middle of the North Sea, that kind of thing. It does, as I said, it focuses on the near inshore stuff.
So it does things like, I assume they were doing the monopiles.
No, they do things like sort of the cable ducts. Basically, massive cable ducts underneath the on the ocean floor, on the sea floor, bringing the power into onto shore, and they've got a job coming up next year.
Also, very political infrastructure.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, I mean, they've got a 6-month job lined up next year at Hinkley Point C, helping with the construction of a fish return system or a fish. I can't remember what the exact phrase is. Basically,
it's the thing that stops the fish getting killed or too many of them.
Yeah, it gives them a way out so that they don't get sucked into the turbines. So they'll be doing that next year, that kind of thing. And installing cofferdams at Dover Docks. I mean, this was a couple of years ago. I did write an article about it, although they only got a mention in passing in that one. But there were a lot of tubular steel piles installed to build a new wharf at Dover Docks, and they did that. So they do piling, that kind of thing. They've recently been working near the Thames Barrier. I don't know exactly on what, but I've seen some very good photographs of a rather smart new 300-ton Kobelco crawler crane, which they've recently bought, sitting on one of their jack-up rigs out by the Thames Barrier. So, and they've done loads of stuff in the Thames.
Would they keep the crawler tracks on that, or would it be pedestal mounted, fixed mounted onto a barge?
Good question. I think probably it's on its standard crawlers. I would have thought so. Anyway, the pictures I've seen, doesn't appear to be a pedestal.
Right.
I mean, their jack-up barges are obviously very versatile things. I suppose if you were to turn one in, if you were to mount a pedestal on the middle of one of these jack-up barges, it would then become just a crane barge. And yes. I think they'd like things to be a little bit more flexible than that.
I was going to say that if you take the tracks off it, you reduce flexibility for how you can use it. But yes, the advantage, I think, if you pedestal mount it, you can probably get more juice out of it, lifting power.
Yes, possibly. Depends how important that is, I suppose.
Yeah. I can see that flexibility would be more important, frankly.
Yeah, I think so. So, yeah, interesting company. Yeah, and as I say, probably one of these companies which you'll see on so many projects and didn't really realise that they get around as much as they do.
Talking of docks, I think you even mentioned Chatham Docks.
I did in passing, but I meant Dover. But Chatham Docks, yeah, that's another interesting story.
We wrote something about it a few years ago when the plans were first mooted. But Chatham Docks ran a piece a couple of weeks ago reporting that Medway Council has approved Peel Water's planning application to close the bit of Chatham Docks that it owns. And they want to build a big one of these, business parks with offices and probably some housing and to get new techie modern business in.
Yeah.
And get rid of the dirty old business, which is already there. Unfortunately, the dirty old business, which is already there, makes rebar for the construction industry. It's where ArcelorMittal uses the dock to import, bring in the steel cable, I guess, and uses it to, and then makes the reinforcing steel in the dock, in its factory in the dock.
Yeah.
And it employs a lot of people there. And it's controversial. It's 2019, the Peel Group announced plans to close the docks by 2025 and redevelop the site for residential and commercial use. And part of the story was that it was going to be uneconomical to refurbish the dock gate, needed refurbishing, and that was going to be too expensive and not worth it, so it was going to shut the dock. Now the people who want to keep the dock open, which is basically ArcelorMittal and people who work there and depend on that factory for their living. Saying, well, the only reason why the Dock Gate's got into such a state is because you've not been investing in it, you've not been maintaining it properly, you've let it go to rack and ruin to give you an excuse to shut the thing. And this is a big Barney.
Well, people say that it's going to cost over £30 million to replace the gate or to repair the gate. I mean, which seems like an awful lot of money. But, you know, that obviously gives them a strong argument for not going ahead with it. It's uneconomical, they say.
But it's the modern world, isn't it? We sweep away old industries and we invite, you know, people who sit at desks, people like you and me, who just sit at a laptop tapping things out to work there instead. And you open up a sandwich shop instead of a greasy spoon or whatever. And it just becomes it's how the world is changing. But it just seems a shame that you've got a viable, this is not British Leyland, we've got a nice viable business which wants to keep going. And they're being kicked out.
On the other hand, it's got a lease, like all the other people in Chatham Dockyard. It leases the space, the property, from Peel Waters, and its lease is going to expire. So, you know, really, does it have a leg to stand on? I mean, Peel says that the dockyard is uneconomical. It's not worth repairing the gate. They can spend the money instead redeveloping it, providing public access for the first time ever. Apparently, they made big play of that, providing, you know, space for new startups, exciting new tech companies and food companies and craft companies and goodness knows what else to flourish there. And it all sounds very good and community orientated. So they seem to think that it's a good idea. And a lot of people locally might think it's a good idea. They'd rather have, you know, posh sandwich shops than rebar factories on their doorstep. And also they'd have access to it for the first time. Medway Council, I think they voted narrowly to approve the
8-7. As tight as you can get it. I mean, that shows how controversial it is. But I'm sure that in that particular constituency, it'll be an election issue. I suspect all the candidates will be defending the people who already have jobs there rather than the people who may at some point in the far distant future have a job on the new development site.
Because they're hypothetical, I suppose, and the people who have jobs there at the moment are real people with real families. And I mean, it will, I think it's become a real hot potato now because of the impending election, because Michael Gove, who was the minister who would have, he was minded to call the application in, wasn't he? But of course, he isn't the minister anymore. It's all up for grabs. So everybody's lobbying now for their side of the argument.
Well, you talked about ArcelorMittal's lease ending next year, so they'll have to leave anyway. I read, it might have been in the Kent Messenger, my local paper, I think it was there, he was quoted as saying that the claim that all the tenants' leases expire in 2025 is not true, because our leases are protected under the Landlord and Tenant Act, and therefore we have automatic right to renew our leases in 2025, which we fully intend to.
Okay. All right.
That's what they say.
Okay. Yes.
But on the flip side,
complicates things.
Your man Whittaker from Peel Waters, Peel Ports, is saying that, look, we'll find them other premises. We don't want to shut them down. We just want to move them out. There's plenty of other places where we can set them up, which would be perhaps even better for them.
I'm sure that's true. I mean, all up and down the East Coast. I mean, we've just been talking about a company based in Ipswich. I mean, Ipswich, Felixstowe, Harwich, you know, all up the East Coast of England, basically.
Yeah, who wants to leave Kent, David?
Well, I did. No, I take your point. I can still remember Chatham Docks when it was a naval dockyard, because my father, who was a naval officer, was based there for a couple of years. And we used to go up there. One of his responsibilities was the sailing centre, which we took full advantage of, and used to take a boat out and sail it around the Medway estuary. Haven't been back since the mid-70s, so I have no idea what it's like there now.
I suspect it's... I suspect it's changed, but probably not as much as the Peel Group would like it to have done.
No, probably.
Yes, the naval dock, the Royal Dockyard shut in 1984. It shut down.
Oh, right.
And there are the three different bits. I've just got a note in front of me. Chatham Historic Dockyard Trust have a bit. English Estates have a bit. Medway Ports Authority has a bit. And that's the Medway Ports Authority bit is what that's Peel now owns.
Peel stuff, yeah.
Three. Yeah. Right. Well, we'll watch that with interest, see what happens in Chatham. It's only up the road from me, so I should be more knowledgeable about it than I am. Get up there.
Yeah, have a day out.
Yes. Well, listeners, producer Tom has just told me that it's time to wrap, but I don't know how to. But he might have meant wrap with a W. I'm not sure. So I will end right now with say thank you very much to you for listening. We hope we haven't overdone the politics. I know that it's getting a little bit tiresome. I think David's even more fed up than I am. So we'll find something else to talk about next time. But we're back with you in 2 weeks' time. We will.
Yeah, we will, of course. Yes. Yeah.
All righty. So, for another episode of Reconstruction, from David and I, cheerio.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.